Bruce Springsteen says he appreciates his British fans. They voted his song Born to Run the greatest pop song of all time. And Queen Elizabeth showed a soft spot for hard rock. Eric Clapton appeared on her New Year's honors list. It is Sunday, the first day of January, and 1995. We're back after this news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Michael Leland. Russian attack helicopters have been buzzing the hills near Chechnya's capital Grozny today. Yesterday, heavy fighting was reported in the city. In his New Year's message from Moscow, Russian President Boris Yeltsin said his most important task this year will be to restore peace to the Chechen Republic. The BBC's Paul Anderson reports from Moscow.
Mr. Yeltsin appeared on television, clearly well recovered from the nose operation which kept him in hospital for the early stage of the campaign in Chechnya. He had especially warm wishes for those servicemen now risking their lives, he said, in defense of Russia and her people. He added that no effort should be spared in returning the tens of thousands of refugees displaced by more than 3 weeks of fighting to their homes. The president faces formidable challenges in dealing with the aftermath of the conflict. He intends to install members of the Chechen opposition in a new government of national rebirth ahead of fresh elections. But he must still subdue the Chechen rebels, who throughout the campaign have sworn to defend their self-declared independence to the death. Many have said they will fight a guerrilla war from bases in the mountains to the south of Grozny.
Paul Anderson reporting. An extended ceasefire in Bosnia-Herzegovina is underway. The truce went into effect at noon local time today and is aimed at giving the warring parties time to work out a lasting peace. The truce also calls for all utilities to be restored and freedom of movement for UN forces. Dozens of ceasefires have been broken in the Bosnian conflict, and there are doubts that this one will hold. A Wisconsin welfare experiment that begins today will cut off cash benefits after 2 years. Critics say the work, not welfare plan is an unrealistic proposal for lifting single mothers out of poverty. From Wisconsin Public Radio, Steve Busolaki reports.
About 1,000 families on aid to families with dependent children will be affected by the pilot program. The idea is to give single parents a specific 2-year deadline for finding self-supporting jobs. Whether they succeed or not, their cash benefit disappears. Pat Gowans is a former AFDC recipient who says it's ridiculous to think this program could provide jobs that pay a living wage.
We're saying to the AFDC mom, listen, honey, you go out there and you do it alone. We're not asking you to supplement any support check. We're going to give you no support check whatsoever for your children.
Gowans says you can't support a family with a $5 per hour job. But a state welfare administrator says many single parents who earn the same wage scale are able to make it, and so can AFDC recipients. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Busolaki in Madison, Wisconsin.
It'll cost you an extra 3 cents to mail a letter beginning today. The price of a first-class stamp went up at midnight to 32 cents. Heavier letters are still 23 cents for each ounce beyond the first. Most other postal rates are going up as well, including newspapers, magazines, parcels, and advertising mail. International rates are headed up too. You're listening to NPR News. The man suspected of killing two people at Boston-area abortion clinics has a hearing set Tuesday in Virginia. Police in Norfolk, Virginia arrested John Salvi yesterday after he allegedly fired 23 bullets at another clinic. He's being held on charges of firing at an occupied building. Salvi faces first-degree murder charges in Massachusetts in connection with Friday shootings. 5 other people were wounded in those incidents. A hospital fire in Petersburg, Virginia has killed 4 people. Police say it started in a patient's room on the 4th floor of the Southside Regional Medical Center. It forced the evacuation of the top 3 floors. All of the dead were patients. It took firefighters about 2 hours to bring the flames under control. If your New Year's resolution is to find a job or get a new one, some experts agree that this is the best time to do it. NPR's Doreen McAllister reports.
Experts say job hunting prospects are a lot better now than they have been the last couple of years. Many companies have pushed their current staffs to overtime maximums, and workers now are opting for free time rather than more money. Officials say while overtime remains at record levels, companies are beginning to hire permanent employees. Many companies have wrapped up their calendar year and are beginning to think of staffing needs for this year. Their budgets have been set, and most know what their hiring capacity is going to be. Job candidates who seriously start looking now and have the right credentials can walk into a new job. Some new job seekers often put their hunt on hold while they celebrate the holidays or assume that no one is hiring at this time of year. Those who stick it out find they're competing with fewer candidates and have a better chance of getting a job interview. I'm Doreen McAllister in Washington.
The UN Security Council has a more European look today as Germany and Italy join the council for the next 2 years. Britain and France are permanent members of the council. Botswana, Indonesia, and Honduras also begin their 2-year terms today. I'm Michael Leland, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Weekend Edition. I'm Leanne Hansen. A man suspected of shooting at 3 abortion clinics in 2 states is in police custody in Norfolk, Virginia this morning. Authorities arrested 22-year-old John Salvi III yesterday afternoon after he sprayed bullets into an abortion clinic in Norfolk. On Friday, a man fitting Salvi's description entered 2 abortion clinics in a suburb of Boston and opened fire, killing 2 and wounding 5. The shootings were the worst violence ever against abortion providers in the United States. Jennifer Ludden of member station WBUR in Boston reports.
Unlike other recent violent acts against abortion clinics, this weekend's shootings were not directed at doctors or other clinic workers. They were random and repeated, and they hit abortion clinic employees and friends of clients, even threatening anti-abortion demonstrators outside one location. On Friday in Boston, the assailant was able to hit 2 nearby clinics, then drive away unstopped. But yesterday, B.E. Overton of the Norfolk, Virginia Police Department says there were witnesses who acted fast when they saw John Salvi stand in a parking lot, take aim at a second-floor abortion clinic, fire, then flee in a pickup truck.
An arson investigator that happened to witness it, along with Norfolk police, was able to stop the truck. The man was arrested without resistance. The building was occupied at the time of the shooting, but nobody was injured.
After he was apprehended, Salvi threw a .22-caliber rifle out his truck window. Authorities say they don't know why Salvi was in Virginia. They speculate he may have been traveling to his parents' home in Florida. New England anti-abortion groups say they had never heard of John Salvi, but colleagues were aware of his views against abortion. Karen Harris was studying hair design with Salvi in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and remembers he taped a photo of an aborted fetus to his truck's rear window.
He never really ranted and raved about his beliefs or anything. We did know how he felt about it, you know, mostly because from seeing the picture on his truck. But he was never one to really talk about it a whole lot. In fact, he didn't talk much at all about anything to anybody. He didn't really have any friends.
Salvi's boss at another hair salon says Salvi was a devout Roman Catholic who didn't want to work on Sundays. Richard Griffin says in the short time he employed Salvi, he talked to him frequently about his lack of interpersonal skills.
For the 5 months he was there, I was always, is it worth it to keep going on with this kid, or should I, you know, just get rid of him? Basically, he was a nice kid. He was motivated and he wanted to do it, but he didn't have the ability to talk and be friendly to people, which is really important.
Griffin says Salvi was finally fired 2 weeks ago after arguing with a customer over where to hang the customer's coat. Outside the targeted abortion clinics in Brookline, Massachusetts yesterday, it was mostly news photographers who gathered to snap photos of the candles and bouquets of flowers placed in honor of the shooting's victims. Authorities have said they have no comment on Salvi's motivation or why he picked the clinics he did. The lack of information and authorities' failure to capture Salvi during his drive from Massachusetts to Virginia continued to frustrate people like Nikki Nichols Gamble of Planned Parenthood.
I am dreadfully sorry that they didn't catch this man before he got to another state and created more difficulty. And I'm, of course, relieved that we hopefully have him now.
Boston area abortion clinics are now closed for the holiday weekend, scheduled to reopen Tuesday. At that time, Massachusetts Attorney General Scott Harshbarger says local and federal officials will work jointly to provide stepped-up security. Harshbarger says the state will also seek to calm the tensions the shootings have caused in a wealthy neighborhood known for its safe streets.
We will be launching a special effort to ensure that there are special counseling services available, not only to the victims of the shootings themselves, but to all others who are part of the community that has been victimized.
John Salvi is expected to be returned to Massachusetts this week for prosecution on 2 charges of murder and 5 charges of attempted murder. If convicted of murder, he would face mandatory life in prison. For National Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Ludden in Boston.
The fighting in the city of Grozny is house to house and in some cases hand to hand this morning. The capital city of the breakaway Russian Republic is the scene of tank duels and sniper fire between Russian troops and Chechens who are offering fierce resistance. NPR's Anne Garrels visited Grozny earlier today.
When we got in there this morning, we basically saw the aftermath of what had been an obviously fierce tank battle last night. According to eyewitnesses, hundreds, we don't know how many tanks exactly, came into the center of Grozny for the first time. There was a lot of shelling back and forth, a lot more destruction in the center of Grozny. Several more residential buildings were utterly destroyed. We don't know how many victims there were. I saw one dead person on the street, but presumably there were more, although most people have left Grozny by now or had gone into the cellars. Today, this morning, there were the carcasses of several burned-out Russian tanks and armored personnel carriers. The Chechens had managed to capture several and were driving around in quite a buoyant mood. The other tanks, as far as we know, had pulled out. One Russian tank was cornered and was shelling, sort of in desperation, trying to break out. It was surrounded by Chechens. And there was a lot of sniper fire because presumably those Russians who were in the armored personnel carriers that were attacked and burned, those who weren't killed, fled. And they're now around the city hiding out, and they're moving fast, and there's sniper fire coming in all directions.
What about the parliament buildings, government buildings, railway station on fire, still standing? In whose control?
The Russians don't appear to have stayed in the city. They appear to have pulled out except those who were stuck there. And in fact, some Russian deputies who were in from Moscow, from the parliament there, came down to see the situation for themselves. They have once again protested to President Yeltsin, and they say that Russian soldiers, they talked to four Russian captives there. They say the Chechens are taking good care of them, but they say the Russians, military, basically didn't tell them what they were doing, didn't explain to them that they were going into battle, didn't give them sufficient ammunition, and they're demanding basically Defense Minister Pavel Grachev's head, saying that he has basically not only it is, in their view, an immoral operation, but it's a terribly badly organized one.
Where is Chechen leader Dudayev at this point?
He does not appear to be in the presidential palace. That has not been hit, curiously. The parliament building was hit and was on fire yesterday, but the only fires I saw today were gas lines that had been hit. The oil refinery that was hit, I couldn't get to because of the shelling. It was just too fierce today to really cross the town. I spent most of the time basically hiding behind buildings.
What's next, do you think, from your perspective and your vantage point there?
The mood changed in just a few hours. I was in Grozny. Early this morning, there I saw a few Chechen soldiers. As the hours went by, more and more were running into the capital to help defend it. This has truly united the Chechens. And they say to you, this isn't for Dudayev that we're fighting. We're fighting for our honor. And they said, the Russians may think they can come into Grozny and that will be the end of it, but they're wrong. They can level the city, but they can't defeat us. They can only destroy us. We will keep fighting. And certainly that was the opinion of the Russian deputies when they came out, and their advice to Yeltsin was, you're out of your mind, basically. The Chechens are not going to give up.
NPR's Anne Garrels on the border in Chechnya. Thanks very much, Anne.
Thank you.
We turn now to NPR's Brooke Gladstone at our bureau in Moscow. Good morning, Brooke.
Good morning.
Picking up on what Anne Garrels said, Russian Defense Minister Pavel Grachev has said he expects the conflict in Chechnya to be over and Chechnya to be firmly in Russia's control by January 15th. Is this assessment realistic?
Who knows? 3 weeks ago, when this whole adventure began, some Russian military leaders were saying the whole thing would be over in 2 hours. Now, finally, they are fighting in the capital, Grozny. It could take days or even weeks, some people say, to subdue that city. And if and when they do, Chechen fighters have vowed to take to the hills, fight a guerrilla war, and resort to terrorism if need be.
What is the political reaction in Moscow, given what Anne Garrels had said about advice being given to Boris Yeltsin that he's out of his mind?
Well, just recently, Patriarch Alexei has called for peace, and Yeltsin's old allies seem to be abandoning him in flocks. Yesterday on the radio, one reformer in the parliament, Boris Zalatuchin, summed up the fears of the Democrats when he said, and I have the quote right here, "The adventure in Chechnya shows that the romantic period of hope is over and that we are heading with giant steps towards a police state." What he means is that Yeltsin seems to be listening to no one but his own security people these days, and there's no way to control or even predict what he'll do next.
New Year's is a very important holiday in Moscow. How has the news from Chechnya affected the spirit this year?
Well, a lot of the usual things happened. Kids gathered at Red Square. Some people smashed their champagne bottles against Lenin's tomb, and you saw the usual gatherings of nostalgic communists waving the hammer and sickle flags. But the toasts on television to the public last night were very long and very solemn, I thought. And you heard the firecrackers going off way, way, way into the morning, and at least to me it sounded more ominous than celebratory. Yegor Gaidar, Yeltsin's former prime minister and the staunch economic reformer in the parliament, offered a holiday message that seemed to sum up the mood. He said, "I would like to wish our citizens simply that our children may come through 1995 alive."
NPR's Brooke Gladstone in Moscow. Thank you very much, Brooke, and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, Leanne.
It's 18 minutes past the hour.
I'm Michael Leland with these news headlines. It may be a little quieter than usual throughout most of the world today. Millions of people celebrated the beginning of the new year through the night by eating, drinking, dancing, and in many places, setting off fireworks. In the Philippines, the fireworks and gunfire got out of hand. 16 people died and more than 800 around the country were injured. In one Pakistani state, all New Year's parties were banned when Muslim fundamentalists threatened to disrupt them. And a 4-month ceasefire has gone into effect in Bosnia-Herzegovina. The truce is aimed at giving the warring parties time to work out a more lasting peace. There have been dozens of ceasefires in the Bosnian conflict, all eventually broken. I'm Michael Leland, NPR News in Washington.
The hijacking last week of a French airliner by Algerian terrorists is having political ramifications throughout the Islamic world. The Algerian-based armed Islamic group, which carried out the hijacking, is just one of several Muslim extremist factions trying to topple Algeria's military government. And as NPR's Sunni Khalid reports, the Algerian crisis has put the United States in an awkward position.
Clinton administration officials are closely following developments in the Algerian civil war amid growing concerns that political violence may increasingly spill across international borders. But U.S. officials disagree on whether the recent events in Algeria mark the beginning of a new campaign of political violence against the West. The banned Islamic Salvation Front, known as the FIS, condemned the Marseille hijacking, but Neil Livingston, an analyst on international terrorism, says Algerian extremist groups, like the Armed Islamic Group, may become more willing and able to wage a campaign of political violence outside of Algeria. Indeed, the group has declared open war on France following the recapture of the commandeered Air France jetliner in Marseille, in which 4 hijackers were killed.
Heretofore, most of their targets have been in Algeria itself. They may be French, but they're in Algeria. This is a very clear statement by the terrorists and by the FIS and its supporters in Algeria that they are going to carry the struggle to the French in particular, and maybe to other backers of the Algerian regime outside its borders.
It is not surprising the Algerian conflict may play itself out in France. In the late 1950s and early 60s, during Algeria's war of independence against French colonialism, Algerian nationalist guerrillas often struck at targets inside France. Since Algeria's military government canceled democratic elections almost 3 years ago, France has not only sided against Algeria's Islamic opposition, but also launched its own crackdown against exiled Algerian militants. About 70 foreigners, including oil workers and priests, from countries like France, Italy, and Spain, have been among the 30,000 people targeted and killed during the civil war. So far, no attacks have been made against Americans or American interests in Algeria. Administration officials say extremist groups could target Americans in the future, and the State Department has issued an advisory against traveling to Algeria. William Quant, a former National Security Staff member under President Carter, said even if more foreigners are targeted by extremists, it would be a mistake to portray the struggle for power in Algeria as a contest between political Islam and the West.
There are, however, specific places where there's a very intense confrontation, primarily between Islamic political movements and their own regimes. Now, because many of those regimes are supported by Western governments, for example, Algeria gets strong support from France, there's a spillover from time to time in the sense that the radical Islamic movements that are basically trying to get rid of their own governments will strike out at Western powers.
Perhaps one reason why the United States hasn't been attacked is because the Clinton administration's policy has remained essentially neutral in the Algerian crisis. Instead, Washington supports the idea of dialogue by moderates from both sides to resolve the crisis. But an attempted dialogue collapsed 2 months ago, resulting in an upsurge in political violence. Washington is maintaining contact with both regime and opposition groups like the FIS, but has declined to become more involved in framing a solution. Administration officials say there is neither a strong enough national security interest or influence to do more. But some analysts disagree.
You could have said the same thing about Iran.
Again, William Quant.
And yet the Iranian Revolution had enormous impact on the region and on American interests. And I think an Islamic revolution in Algeria will similarly have an impact on countries like Tunisia and Morocco, quite obviously, but also on Egypt and on the peace process.
I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
In my experience, the consumers have been made extremely anxious. And the reason for that is that they've been bombarded through the lay media with messages about all the doom and gloom that's going to happen to them when they hit menopause, and that the answer of this is da-da-da-da, estrogen, the menopause miracle, the magic pill that will sort it all out.
That's Sandra Coney, the author of a new book called The Menopause Industry. Over the last decade, hormone replacement therapy, or HRT, has been the choice of most physicians as a way to deal with the onset of menopause. However, Coney says estrogen taken at the beginning of menopause is no magic pill, and that very few women benefit from regular hormone treatment. Joining us now to discuss this issue are Weekend Edition medical commentators Drs. Miriam Shuckman and Michael Wilkes. Good morning, both of you.
Good morning, Leanne.
Let's get your thoughts. Is estrogen the magic pill for menopause? Michael, start with you.
Well, Leanne, I think that taking hormone replacement is really quite good advice for some women, although I think that it's being pushed a bit too strongly by the medical and pharmaceutical industries. For example, if you read ads in women's magazines or even in medical journals or talk to doctors, you'd think that this really was the absolute end-all and be-all to the longevity of women.
What do you think, Miriam?
Well, this is something, Leanne, where Mike and I don't see eye to eye. From a medical standpoint, what happens to women beginning at the time of menopause is that their risk of heart disease and of having a hip fracture goes way up. These are very serious conditions. I mean, heart disease is the leading killer of women, and hip fractures are the sort of thing where once you have a hip fracture, that can be the first event in a downward spiral which lands a woman, you know, who's just in her 70s in a nursing home. And there are a number of studies to suggest that both of these things can be prevented by taking a daily dose of the hormone replacement therapy. So I feel that this is something many women should be doing.
Michael, have you treated any of your menopausal patients with hormones?
Leanne, I actually do put most of my female patients on these hormones. But there are a lot of reasons that women end up not taking the pills. For example, when I start a woman on hormone replacement therapy, a fair number of them come back complaining about the side effects, specifically the side effects of having a period again. Some people are upset with breast tenderness, of gaining weight, or feeling like they're sick by having to take a pill every single day of their life. In fact, those aren't even the worst problems. The worst problem is probably abnormal bleeding. Now, if a woman has abnormal bleeding or prolonged periods on the medicine, they're going to need a biopsy of their uterus, which is not a whole lot of fun.
Do the benefits, do you think, outweigh the potential side effects?
Well, I certainly do, Leanne. There's a lot of research showing that the beneficial effects of hormone replacement therapy are substantial. As I mentioned, it cuts down the woman's risk of having a hip fracture. It cuts that by 25%. It reduces the risk that a woman will have serious heart disease, a heart attack, for example, by 35%. This is substantial.
I think the bottom line is quality of life. Depending on the person, taking estrogen may improve the quality of life, say by reducing hot flashes or other symptoms, or heading off disease that might occur in the future. But you're going to find other women that find the side effects of these pills decrease the quality of their life, and they decide that they'd rather chance a potential hip fracture in 20 or 30 years and have an improved quality of life now.
Now, hormone replacement therapy is not new. In my introduction, I said, you know, for the past decade, we've talked about it on this program before. Why is it so much in the news now?
Well, one of the reasons it's back in the news is that there is a very recent study that was just announced at the American Heart Association, meaning in the past few months, about a new pill, a combination pill of two hormones that may work better for women than simply using estrogen. And the reason is that this combination pill does reduce the risk of heart disease, but it doesn't give women the added concern of increasing their risk of developing cancer of the uterus. So it looks like this combination pill is going to be very reassuring for women who are interested in hormone replacement therapy.
I'm not quite sure that it's all that rosy. I think that we still haven't seen that study published. There are other studies that suggest that combination therapy isn't quite as strong a protective effect on the heart. And there's also this whole issue of breast cancer, which remains unanswered.
So there are pharmaceutical advances that produced a new pill. What about the ways that doctors view and treat menopause? Have there been advances in that?
Well, Leanne, there are lots of ways that doctors can treat menopause without hormones, specifically by using calcium, by promoting exercise. You know, if I can be a little philosophical for a moment, for years the medical community has had a particularly awkward relationship with middle-aged females. It wasn't terribly long ago that women at the time of menopause were regularly labeled as hypochondriacs. Non-specific complaints around the time of menopause, like hot flashes or inability to sleep or anxiety, were shrugged off to so-called anxiety or the trauma of the change of life. Now, some of this has changed, but we as a medical profession need to be very careful that we're not medicalizing a very human process.
Thanks to our doctors, Miriam Shookman and Michael Wilkes, for joining us in this discussion. Thanks again.
Thank you, Leanne.
Thank you, Leanne.
It began with a big bang eons ago, and our universe has been expanding and perhaps now collapsing ever since. Astronomers are constantly searching for information to confirm or disprove this theory. You see, because of the time it takes for light to travel through space, when astronomers look at extremely distant objects, they in effect are looking backward in time. In a report published in today's Astrophysical Journal, astronomers say they've seen the oldest galaxy ever discovered. NPR's Joe Palca has the story.
Early in 1994, astronomers in Cambridge, England, used a radio telescope to map the sky. In that map, astronomers saw something that looked like it might be an extremely ancient galaxy. James Graham, an astronomer at the University of California at Berkeley, says he and his colleagues decided to try to get a peek at this distant galaxy.
We used the Keck telescope on Mauna Kea, Hawaii, which is the largest optical infrared telescope in the world. And even for that telescope, it's a fairly difficult observation. It required several hours of observations to make the images.
What they found was worth the effort, says Graham. The galaxy with the prosaic name of 8C1435 was indeed a long, long way off. Graham estimates that the galaxy is 15 billion light-years away. That means what Graham and his colleagues were seeing through the Keck telescope was the way old 8C1435 looked when the universe was 15 to 20% of its current age. It's like seeing a picture of a 60-year-old woman when she was only 12, says Graham.
This is the earliest stage we've seen in the evolution of a galaxy. It gives us an insight into when galaxies form, where they come from, what are the processes that cause galaxies to form.
One surprise is that the galaxy had evolved as far as it had. After all, this galaxy was barely out of adolescence in cosmological terms, but according to Graham, the galaxy had already begun to show a definite shape.
It's a large, diffuse object. It's probably the closest thing to what astronomers might have expected to be a proto-galaxy.
So what's meant by a proto-galaxy? You mean you're seeing it as it's forming?
This means what you might expect a galaxy to appear during the first epoch of formation of stars that make up the galaxy. This is actually an extended object. We can see light distributed over a large area.
Large is putting it mildly. Graham and his colleagues reckon that 8C1435 is between 150 and 200,000 light-years across. That would make it 5 times bigger than the Andromeda Galaxy, a large spiral galaxy not far from our own Milky Way. Hiron Spinrad, the leader of the Berkeley team that made the images of 8C1435, says astronomers are constantly searching the skies for older and older objects that will teach them more about the early days of the universe. That way, they hope to learn more about how and why the universe reached its current state. 8C1435 doesn't so much represent a breakthrough as another step in that process.
We've nudged the high jump bar up a little bit.
Uh-huh.
It's like going from 7 feet to 7 feet 6 inches or something like that.
Well, that took a few years to do.
Oh, yeah.
Spinrad says there's still a lot of information to squeeze from 8C1435. That's what he'll be doing over the next few years, as well as continuing the search for even older galaxies. This is Joe Palca in Washington.
You're listening to Weekend Edition.